The recycled air burned my lungs with each labored breath as I hunched over the data slate, cross-referencing grain shipment manifests against actual delivery receipts for the third time that morning. The numbers never matched. They hadn't matched in the 6 months since I'd been transferred to resource allocation monitoring, and the discrepancies were getting worse. My supervisor, Harkin Vex, had made it clear during my first week that questioning these irregularities was not part of my duties, but I couldn't help myself. The Emperor's truth demanded accuracy, and these records were riddled with lies. The coughing fit started again, that wet rasping that had become my constant companion since arriving at Hive Tertius 18 months ago. The medical servitor in the Administratum's health bay had diagnosed it as minor respiratory irritation from the recycling systems, nothing more than an occupational hazard for middle-level clerks like myself. The prescribed inhalers did nothing except drain my meager salary, but I kept buying them anyway. Hope was expensive in the hive, but it was all I had left besides my principles. My workstation occupied a cramped corner of sublevel 47, Administrative Sector Gamma, where 47 other data clerks processed the endless stream of imperial bureaucracy that kept our section of the hive functioning. The promethium fumes from the transport tubes mixed with the perpetual incense smoke from the shrine alcoves, creating a thick haze that made my eyes water constantly. The lumens overhead flickered with mechanical irregularity, casting everything in sickly yellow light that made the parchment and data slates appear aged beyond their years. The grain shipment records told a disturbing story. According to the manifests I'd been reviewing, Hive Tertius received weekly deliveries of approximately 2.3 million kilograms of processed grain from the agricultural worlds in our subsector. The delivery receipts, however, showed only 1.8 million kilograms actually reaching the distribution centers. 500,000 kilograms simply vanished between the orbital freight platforms and the Hive storage facilities every single week. I'd started tracking the pattern after noticing small inconsistencies in my first month. What began as minor clerical errors had revealed itself as systematic theft on a massive scale. Someone was skimming grain shipments meant to feed the underhive populations, and they were doing it with enough coordination to alter multiple sets of records across different departments. The implications made my stomach turn, but the evidence was undeniable. The water ration dispensed from my desk unit tasted of rust and chemical purifiers, but I forced myself to drink it anyway. My throat felt raw from the constant coughing, and dehydration only made the lung rot worse. Three other clerks in my section had developed similar symptoms over the past year, though none seemed as concerned about it as I was. They joked about hive lung and accepted it as part of life in the middle levels. I couldn't understand their resignation. My colleague Davin Kress worked at the station beside mine, processing transportation manifests with the kind of casual indifference that characterized most of the administrative staff. He'd been here for 8 years and had developed the hollow-eyed look of someone who'd stopped caring about anything beyond his next meal and sleep cycle. When I'd mentioned the grain discrepancies to him last month, he'd advised me to focus on my assigned tasks and avoid unnecessary complications. His warning had been friendly enough, but there was something in his tone that suggested genuine concern for my well-being. The systematic nature of the embezzlement became clearer as I dug deeper into the records. The missing grain wasn't random theft by desperate dock workers or transport crews. Someone with administrative access was coordinating the operation, altering shipping manifests before they reached the distribution centers and covering their tracks by adjusting inventory reports across multiple facilities. The skill required suggested involvement from higher-level administratum personnel, possibly even my own department. I'd submitted my first formal report 3 weeks ago, following proper channels by forwarding my findings to Supervisor Vex with copies to the Sector Compliance Office. The response had been swift and disappointing. Vex had summoned me to his office and explained that resource allocation discrepancies were common in hive operations and that my concerns had been noted but required no further action. He'd suggested I focus on processing current manifests rather than conducting unauthorized audits of historical data. The dismissal only strengthened my resolve. If minor discrepancies were normal, then surely someone should be interested in discrepancies involving millions of kilograms of stolen food. I'd spent my off-duty hours compiling additional evidence, cross-referencing transport schedules with delivery confirmations, and identifying specific dates when the largest thefts had occurred. The pattern was clear to anyone willing to look at the data objectively. My health continued to deteriorate as the weeks passed. The lung rot had progressed from occasional coughing fits to constant wheezing that made sleep nearly impossible. The contaminated water rations weren't helping, but clean water cost more than I could afford on a clerk's salary. I tried boiling the ration water in my HAB unit, but the heating element in my stove had failed last month, and replacement parts were beyond my budget. Everything in the hive seemed designed to extract maximum suffering from minimum resources. The other clerks had begun avoiding me, though I wasn't sure whether it was because of my persistent coughing or my reputation for asking uncomfortable questions about departmental procedures. Kress still nodded politely when we passed in the corridors, but he no longer lingered for casual conversation during meal breaks. The isolation was harder to bear than the physical discomfort, but I couldn't compromise my principles for social acceptance. My second report had been more detailed, including specific manifest numbers and transport codes that could be traced to individual shipments. I documented 17 separate incidents over the past 4 months where grain shipments had been reduced between orbital receipt and hive distribution. The evidence was irrefutable, presented in the precise format required by administratum regulations for reporting suspected fraud or corruption. Supervisor Vex's reaction to the second report had been less patient than his first. He reminded me that my duties involved data entry and verification, not investigative analysis of departmental operations. He'd suggested that my health problems might be affecting my judgment and recommended that I request medical leave to address my respiratory issues. The implication was clear, but I'd politely declined and returned to my workstation to continue my assigned duties. The grain thefts weren't the only irregularities I'd discovered in the administrative records. Transportation fuel allocations showed similar patterns of systematic skimming, though on a smaller scale. Medical supply shipments displayed consistent shortfalls that suggested coordinated theft rather than random pilferage. Even basic maintenance supplies for the hive's infrastructure systems showed evidence of organized embezzlement. The corruption appeared to extend throughout the entire resource allocation network. I'd begun keeping personal copies of the most damning evidence in my HAB unit, stored on data wafers that I purchased with my own funds. If something happened to the official records, at least there would be some documentation of the crimes I'd uncovered. The precaution seemed paranoid, but my growing understanding of the situation suggested that paranoia might be justified. Too many people had too much to lose if the truth came to light. My third report had been submitted directly to the Sector Compliance Office, bypassing Supervisor Vex entirely. The regulations clearly stated that suspected fraud could be reported through multiple channels, and I'd followed proper procedures by including all relevant documentation and cross-references. The response had taken 2 weeks to arrive, and it had been even more discouraging than my supervisor's dismissals. The compliance office had thanked me for my diligence, but explained that resource allocation variations were within acceptable parameters for hive operations. The official response had included a subtle warning about the consequences of filing frivolous reports with imperial authorities. Wasting the time of compliance officers was considered a serious offense, potentially resulting in disciplinary action or reassignment to less desirable positions within the administratum hierarchy. The message was clear enough, but I couldn't abandon my pursuit of justice simply because it was inconvenient for corrupt officials. My workstation had become a fortress of evidence, surrounded by stacks of printed manifests and data slates containing months of research. The other clerks gave my area a wide berth, treating me like a contaminated zone that might spread whatever madness had infected my dedication to accuracy. Their avoidance was probably wise, considering how my investigation had begun affecting my standing within the department. The physical symptoms of hive lung had progressed beyond mere inconvenience to genuine disability. Climbing the stairs to my HAB unit left me gasping for breath, and the constant coughing had begun producing flecks of blood that stained my work clothes. The medical bay's servitor had prescribed stronger inhalers, but they cost more than my weekly food allowance and provided only temporary relief. I'd started rationing their use, saving them for the worst attacks while trying to endure the constant discomfort. The transfer notice arrived on my data slate 3 days after my fourth report to the Sector Compliance Office. Supervisor Vex had delivered it personally, standing beside my workstation with the kind of satisfied expression that suggested he'd been anticipating this moment for weeks. The document was brief and formal, reassigning me from resource allocation monitoring to quality assurance in the industrial sector, effective immediately. My new position would involve inspecting ammunition components in Manufactorum Block 7, located in the lower industrial levels, where the real work of keeping the Imperium armed took place. Vex explained that my attention to detail and commitment to accuracy made me an ideal candidate for quality inspection duties. The irony wasn't lost on me, considering how my reports about grain theft had been systematically ignored by every level of the administrative hierarchy. My reassignment was clearly punishment disguised as promotion, a way to remove me from sensitive records while maintaining the pretense that my concerns had been addressed through proper channels. The descent to the industrial levels took 47 minutes using the cargo lifts, each floor deeper into the hive's mechanical heart, revealing new layers of noise and chemical contamination. The recycled air grew thicker with each level, heavy with metallic particles and the acrid smell of industrial solvents. My respiratory condition worsened noticeably during the journey, forcing me to pause several times to catch my breath while other workers pushed past with the casual indifference of people accustomed to human suffering. Manufactorum Block 7 occupied 3 full levels of the industrial sector, its massive assembly lines producing LAS-PAC power cells for Imperial Guard regiments across the subsector. The facility operated continuously, with 3 shifts of workers maintaining production quotas that seemed designed to extract maximum output while minimizing safety considerations. The noise level was immediately overwhelming, a constant din of hydraulic presses, conveyor mechanisms, and chemical processing equipment that made normal conversation impossible. My supervisor in the new position was Foreman Krushev, a heavyset man whose face bore the permanent scars of chemical burns from his years working the assembly lines before his promotion. He led me through the facility's main production floor, shouting explanations about quality control procedures over the mechanical roar, while pointing out various inspection stations where I would be conducting my duties. The tour felt perfunctory, as if he was fulfilling a bureaucratic requirement rather than genuinely preparing me for the work ahead. The inspection station assigned to me was positioned between 2 massive chemical vats where power cell electrolyte solutions were mixed and processed. The toxic vapors rising from the open containers made my eyes water immediately, and the constant exposure to these fumes would clearly accelerate the deterioration of my already compromised respiratory system. The previous inspector had been transferred to medical leave after developing severe lung complications, though Krushev mentioned this detail with the casual indifference of someone discussing routine equipment maintenance. My duties involved examining finished LAS-PAC power cells for defects in construction, proper electrolyte levels, and correct power output ratings. Each cell required visual inspection, electronic testing, and documentation before being approved for shipment to Imperial Guard units. The work was tedious but important, considering that defective ammunition could result in weapon failures during combat situations where soldiers' lives depended on reliable equipment. The first batch of power cells I inspected revealed disturbing irregularities that immediately reminded me of the grain shipment discrepancies I'd discovered in my previous position. Approximately 15% of the cells showed power output readings significantly below Imperial specifications, yet they had already been marked as approved for shipment by previous quality inspectors. The defective units would likely cause LAS weapons to misfire or fail completely during combat operations, potentially resulting in Imperial Guard casualties on distant battlefields. I began documenting the defective power cells, recording their serial numbers and specific deficiencies in the official inspection logs. The pattern quickly became apparent as I worked through subsequent batches over the following days. The defects weren't random manufacturing errors, but appeared to be deliberate sabotage, with specific components being damaged or replaced with substandard materials before final assembly. Someone was systematically compromising Imperial Guard ammunition while maintaining the appearance of normal production quotas. The chemical exposure in the Manufactorum was taking a severe toll on my health, with my respiratory symptoms worsening dramatically within the first week of my reassignment. The toxic vapors from the electrolyte processing vats caused constant burning in my throat and lungs, while the metallic particles in the air left me coughing up dark, bloody phlegm that stained my work clothes and made breathing increasingly difficult. The facility's medical station dispensed basic respiratory protection masks, but they provided minimal relief from the concentrated chemical atmosphere. My incident reports documenting the defective ammunition began disappearing from the official logs within hours of submission. I would complete detailed documentation of power cell defects, submit the reports through proper channels, and return the next day to find no record of my findings in the system. The defective cells I had rejected were being processed for shipment anyway, despite my documented objections and the clear evidence of their substandard performance. The pattern of systematic sabotage became clearer as I continued my inspection duties over the following weeks. The defective power cells weren't random failures, but showed evidence of deliberate tampering with specific components. Electrolyte solutions were being diluted with cheaper chemicals that reduced power output, while internal circuitry was being damaged in ways that would cause delayed failures during extended use. The sabotage was sophisticated enough to avoid detection during cursory inspections while ensuring weapon failures under combat conditions. I began keeping personal documentation of the defective ammunition, using my own data wafers to record serial numbers, defect descriptions, and photographic evidence of the sabotaged components. The precaution seemed necessary given how my official reports were being systematically erased from the facility's records. If Imperial Guard soldiers were going to die because of defective ammunition, at least there would be some record of my attempts to prevent the tragedy. The other quality inspectors at the facility had clearly learned to ignore the defective ammunition rather than risk the complications that came with accurate reporting. They processed their assigned quotas with mechanical efficiency, approving batches of power cells without conducting thorough inspections and maintaining production schedules that prioritized quantity over quality. Their approach was pragmatic from a career survival perspective, but it represented a fundamental betrayal of their duty to the Emperor and the soldiers who would depend on their work. My fellow workers began avoiding me within the first month of my assignment to the Manufactorum. The combination of my persistent coughing, my reputation for filing troublesome reports, and my obvious deteriorating health made me a pariah among people who had learned to keep their heads down and avoid attracting attention from supervisors. The isolation was particularly difficult in an environment where teamwork and mutual support were essential for surviving the dangerous working conditions. The industrial accidents began occurring with suspicious frequency after my second week of documenting defective ammunition. A hydraulic press malfunctioned near my workstation, sending metal fragments flying through the area where I had been standing moments earlier. A chemical spill from one of the electrolyte vats created a toxic cloud that forced evacuation of my inspection area, though other sections of the facility continued operating normally. The incidents could have been coincidental, but their timing and location suggested deliberate attempts to silence my reporting activities. My respiratory condition had progressed beyond the chronic coughing and wheezing to include severe chest pain and episodes where I struggled to breathe at all. The combination of toxic chemical exposure and the underlying lung rot from my previous assignment was creating a medical crisis that the facility's basic health services were completely inadequate to address. I needed proper medical treatment, but the cost was beyond my salary, and the administratum's health benefits didn't cover conditions classified as self-inflicted through poor lifestyle choices. The documentation I was accumulating painted a disturbing picture of systematic corruption that extended far beyond simple quality control failures. The sabotaged ammunition was being produced according to specific patterns that suggested coordination between multiple levels of the facility's management structure. Production schedules were being manipulated to ensure that defective batches were mixed with legitimate ammunition in ratios that would avoid detection during random inspections by higher authorities. Foreman Krushev had begun assigning me to increasingly dangerous inspection duties, positioning me near equipment with poor safety records, and requiring me to work with chemicals that aggravated my respiratory condition. The assignments were presented as routine job requirements, but the pattern suggested a deliberate effort to either force my resignation or create conditions where an industrial accident might solve the problem of my troublesome reporting permanently. The scope of the ammunition sabotage became clearer as I gained access to shipping manifests and delivery schedules for the defective power cells. The compromised ammunition was being distributed to specific Imperial Guard regiments rather than random units, suggesting that the sabotage was targeted at particular military formations. The implications were staggering, indicating possible coordination with enemies of the Imperium who would benefit from Imperial Guard weapon failures during critical combat operations. My personal documentation had grown to include hundreds of defective power cells, each one representing potential Imperial Guard casualties on battlefields across the galaxy. The evidence was comprehensive and undeniable, but my inability to get official attention for the problem was becoming increasingly frustrating. Every proper channel I had tried had resulted in my reports being ignored, dismissed, or simply erased from the records as if they had never existed. The mysterious accidents around my workstation were escalating in both frequency and severity. A crane malfunction had dropped a load of metal components near my inspection area, while a steam pipe rupture had filled my work zone with scalding vapor that forced me to seek medical attention for minor burns. The facility's safety officer attributed the incidents to normal industrial hazards, but their concentration around my specific workstation was statistically improbable. My health had deteriorated to the point where climbing the stairs to my HAB unit required multiple rest stops, and my constant coughing was producing increasingly alarming amounts of blood. The chemical burns on my hands and arms from exposure to the electrolyte solutions were becoming infected despite my attempts to treat them with basic medical supplies. I was slowly dying from the combination of toxic exposure and deliberate neglect, but I couldn't abandon my duty to document the ammunition sabotage that was endangering Imperial Guard soldiers across the subsector. The final transfer notice came without ceremony, delivered by a junior administratum clerk who seemed eager to complete his task and leave the toxic atmosphere of Manufactorum Block 7. My reassignment to Underhive Waste Reclamation Services was effective immediately, and the clerk's nervous glances at my blood-stained work clothes suggested he understood exactly what kind of position awaited me in the depths of Hive Tertius. The document cited my continued health problems as grounds for reassignment to duties more suitable for workers with compromised respiratory systems, though we both knew this was simply another step in my systematic removal from any position where I might uncover inconvenient truths. The descent to the Underhive took nearly 2 hours using the maintenance lifts, each level deeper revealing new depths of human misery and mechanical decay. The walls grew slick with condensation and chemical seepage as we descended, while the air became thick with the stench of organic waste and industrial runoff that pooled in the lowest sections of the hive structure. My breathing difficulties worsened dramatically during the journey, forcing me to stop frequently while other passengers pressed themselves against the lift walls to avoid contact with my increasingly violent coughing fits. The waste reclamation facility occupied a sprawling complex of interconnected chambers carved directly into the hive's foundation bedrock, where the accumulated refuse of millions of citizens was processed, sorted, and prepared for recycling into useful materials. The facility operated continuously to handle the massive volume of waste generated by the upper levels, with crews of workers sorting through everything from discarded clothing to broken machinery in search of materials that could be salvaged and returned to the hive's production systems. My new supervisor was a grizzled veteran named Kellen Thrace, whose scarred hands and chemical-burned face testified to decades of working in the Underhive's most dangerous environments. He led me through the facility's main processing chambers without bothering to explain safety procedures or working conditions, apparently assuming that anyone assigned to waste reclamation already understood they were at the bottom of the Hive's social hierarchy. The tour felt like a formality rather than genuine preparation for the work ahead. The specific section assigned to me was the organic waste processing area, where human corpses from throughout the Hive were delivered for final disposition. The bodies came from multiple sources, including gang violence, industrial accidents, disease outbreaks, and the simple attrition of underhive life, arriving in various states of decomposition that required different processing methods. My duties involved cataloging the corpses, removing any salvageable materials or identifying documents, and preparing the remains for conversion into basic organic compounds that could be used in the Hive's agricultural systems. The first batch of corpses I processed revealed the brutal reality of life in the lower levels of Hive Tertius. Most showed evidence of violent death from Law's weapon burns, blade wounds, or blunt force trauma that spoke to the constant warfare between rival gangs competing for territory and resources. The bodies were typically stripped of anything valuable before delivery to the facility, leaving behind only the basic organic matter that could be recycled into useful materials through chemical processing. The toxic atmosphere in the organic processing chambers was immediately overwhelming, with chemical vapors from the decomposition vats mixing with the natural gases produced by rotting flesh to create a miasma that burned my throat and lungs with each breath. The combination of my existing respiratory condition and this new level of toxic exposure caused my health to deteriorate rapidly, with my daily coughing fits now producing alarming quantities of blood that stained the processing chamber floors. Within my first week of working in waste reclamation, I began noticing patterns in the corpses that suggested systematic violence rather than random gang warfare. Many of the bodies showed evidence of execution-style killings, with precise Law's weapon burns to the head or neck that indicated professional rather than amateur violence. The weapons used appeared to be military grade rather than the improvised firearms typically associated with underhive gangs, suggesting involvement by better equipped forces. The discovery that changed everything came during my third week of processing corpses from the Rust Quarter, one of the most violent sectors of the Underhive where gang warfare was particularly intense. Among the usual collection of gang members and civilians caught in crossfire, I found the body of a young man whose clothing and equipment immediately caught my attention. He wore the distinctive flak armor of an arbitrator patrol officer, though his gear had been stripped of most identifying marks before his body was delivered to the facility. The dead arbitrator's presence in a batch of gang violence casualties seemed unusual enough to warrant investigation, particularly given the precision of the Law's weapon wound that had killed him. I began examining his personal effects more carefully, discovering a concealed data slate that had been overlooked by whoever had processed his body before delivery. The device was damaged but still functional, containing patrol logs and communication records that revealed disturbing information about arbitrator operations in the Underhive. The patrol logs documented systematic corruption within the local arbitrator forces, with detailed records of weapons confiscated during gang arrests being sold back to the same criminal organizations within days of their seizure. The dead officer had been documenting these transactions with dates, locations, and the names of specific arbitrators involved in the illegal weapons trade. His records showed that confiscated Law's weapons, stub guns, and even military-grade equipment were being recycled back into gang hands through a network of corrupt law enforcement officials. The implications were staggering as I read through the officer's carefully documented evidence. The arbitrators weren't simply failing to control gang violence in the Underhive. They were actively perpetuating it by ensuring that criminal organizations remained well-armed and capable of continued warfare. The constant stream of corpses flowing through my processing facility wasn't the result of uncontrolled criminal activity, but rather the deliberate product of a system designed to generate violence for profit. The data slate contained communication records showing coordination between corrupt arbitrators and specific gang leaders, with arrangements for staged arrests that would remove weapons from circulation temporarily before returning them through black market sales. The system was sophisticated enough to maintain the appearance of effective law enforcement while actually ensuring that gang warfare continued at levels that justified continued arbitrator presence and funding in the underhive sectors. My attempts to process this information while continuing my corpse cataloging duties became increasingly difficult as my respiratory condition worsened to the point where I was coughing up blood several times per day. The toxic atmosphere in the organic processing chambers was accelerating the deterioration of my lungs, while the stress of discovering evidence of systematic corruption was taking a psychological toll that made concentration nearly impossible. The dead arbitrator's records included references to higher-level officials who were aware of the weapons recycling operation, suggesting that the corruption extended well beyond individual patrol officers into the command structure of the local arbitrator forces. Names and rank designations appeared throughout the communication logs, indicating that the illegal weapons trade had official sanction from supervisory personnel who were profiting from the continued violence in the underhive. I began documenting my findings using the same careful methods I had employed during my previous investigations, copying the arbitrator's data onto personal storage devices while maintaining detailed notes about the patterns of violence I was observing in the corpse processing facility. The evidence was comprehensive and damning, but my previous experiences with official channels suggested that normal reporting procedures would be ineffective against corruption of this magnitude. The physical demands of corpse processing were becoming unbearable as my lung condition progressed beyond chronic illness to acute medical crisis. Each day of exposure to the toxic atmosphere in the organic waste chambers left me weaker and more disabled, while the constant handling of decomposing bodies was causing skin infections and chemical burns that the facility's minimal medical supplies couldn't adequately treat. I was slowly dying from the combination of toxic exposure and deliberate neglect. My decision to contact higher imperial authorities directly came after discovering additional data slates hidden among the personal effects of other dead arbitrators who had been processed through the facility over recent months. The pattern suggested that honest law enforcement officers were being systematically eliminated to protect the weapons trafficking operation, with their bodies disposed of through the waste reclamation system to avoid awkward questions about their deaths. The Vox communication array in the facility's administrative section provided access to external channels that could theoretically reach imperial authorities beyond the local hive structure. I spent several days learning to operate the equipment during my off-duty hours, using technical manuals from the facility's archives to understand the complex procedures required for long-range communication with subsector command authorities. My first attempt to contact the subsector arbitrator command resulted in a response that was both swift and discouraging. The duty officer who received my transmission listened to my summary of the evidence I had uncovered before explaining that local law enforcement matters were handled through proper channels within the hive's administrative hierarchy. He recommended that I submit my concerns to my immediate supervisors and follow established procedures for reporting suspected irregularities. The second communication attempt, directed to the Planetary Governor's office, produced an even more frustrating response. After waiting 3 days for acknowledgement of my transmission, I received a form letter thanking me for my civic concern, while explaining that waste reclamation workers were not authorized to initiate communications with planetary authorities on matters outside their assigned duties. The response included a warning about the serious consequences of filing frivolous reports with imperial officials. My third attempt involved contacting the Adeptus Munitorum offices responsible for overseeing Imperial Guard equipment distribution, given my previous discoveries about sabotaged ammunition in the Manufactorum. The response took nearly a week to arrive, and it contained information that shattered my remaining faith in the Imperial system's ability to address systematic corruption through official channels. The Adeptus Munitorum officer who responded to my communication was already aware of the ammunition sabotage I had documented during my assignment to Manufactorum Block 7. The defective power cells I had identified were being deliberately produced and distributed to specific Imperial Guard regiments as part of a coordinated effort to ensure military failures that would justify increased funding and resources for planetary defense forces. The sabotage wasn't criminal activity, but rather official policy implemented at levels far above my understanding. The realization that my months of careful documentation and health-destroying investigation had uncovered not criminal conspiracy, but sanctioned imperial policy was devastating beyond my ability to process rationally. The grain theft, ammunition sabotage, and weapons trafficking weren't aberrations in the system. They were integral components of how the Imperium actually functioned at the local level. My honesty and dedication to proper procedures had accomplished nothing except ensuring my own systematic destruction. The final communication attempt was directed to the Adeptus Administratum's Internal Affairs Division, responsible for investigating corruption within the Imperial bureaucracy itself. The response arrived within hours rather than days, suggesting that my previous communications had already flagged me as a person of interest to higher authorities. The message was brief and unambiguous, informing me that my pattern of unauthorized communications with Imperial officials constituted grounds for disciplinary action up to, and including summary execution for interfering with official Imperial business. The mental breakdown that followed this final revelation was complete and absolute, as I realized that my commitment to truth and proper procedures had been not just futile but actively harmful to my survival within the Imperial system. Every report I had filed, every piece of evidence I had documented, every attempt to follow proper channels had simply marked me as a threat to be eliminated rather than a loyal servant trying to improve Imperial efficiency. The corpses continued arriving at the processing facility in steady streams, their numbers increasing as gang violence escalated in response to the continued flow of weapons being recycled through corrupt arbitrator networks. Each body I processed represented not just individual tragedy but systematic failure of Imperial institutions that were designed to perpetuate rather than solve the problems they claimed to address. My work had become a daily confrontation with the evidence of my own irrelevance. The blood I was coughing up had increased to the point where my work clothes were permanently stained, while my breathing difficulties made even basic tasks nearly impossible to complete. The toxic atmosphere in the organic processing chambers was killing me as surely as any weapon, but I lacked the resources to seek medical treatment or the authority to request transfer to less hazardous duties. I was trapped in a system designed to consume workers like me, while maintaining the fiction that their sacrifice served some greater imperial purpose. The data slate containing evidence of the food poisoning cover-up had taken me 3 weeks to compile, working through my deteriorating health and the toxic atmosphere of the waste processing facility. Each entry represented dozens of corpses I had cataloged, their deaths attributed to gang violence when the reality was far more systematic and horrifying. The contaminated grain shipments I had first discovered during my time in resource allocation monitoring had been deliberately distributed to the lower underhive levels, resulting in a slow-motion massacre that killed hundreds while maintaining plausible deniability for the officials responsible. My breathing had become so labored that climbing the short flight of stairs to the facility's communication array required multiple rest stops, each one punctuated by violent coughing fits that left bloody spatters on the corroded metal steps. The chemical burns on my hands made operating the data slate painful, while my vision had begun blurring from the constant exposure to toxic vapors in the organic processing chambers. I was dying by degrees, but the compulsion to document the truth had become stronger than my instinct for self-preservation. The pattern of deaths from contaminated grain had been carefully disguised across multiple underhive sectors, with the poisoned food distributed through different gang territories to make the resulting casualties appear unrelated. The symptoms were consistent with ergot contamination, a fungal toxin that caused convulsions, gangrene, and eventual death while being difficult to detect without proper laboratory analysis. The grain shipments had been deliberately infected before distribution, creating a biological weapon that targeted the most vulnerable populations while appearing to be natural contamination. The bodies I processed told the real story of what had happened in the lower levels. Families found dead in their HAB units with the characteristic signs of ergot poisoning, their corpses delivered to the facility with falsified documentation claiming they were gang violence casualties. Children whose small bodies showed the distinctive blackened extremities caused by the toxin, their deaths attributed to random violence rather than systematic poisoning. The elderly and sick who had succumbed first to the contaminated food, their suffering dismissed as natural attrition in the harsh underhive environment. The scope of the cover-up became clear as I cross-referenced the death records with the grain distribution manifests I had copied during my previous assignment. Specific shipments of contaminated grain had been directed to feeding stations and black market distributors in sectors where the population was considered expendable by hive authorities. The poisoning wasn't accidental contamination, but deliberate population control, designed to reduce strain on resources while maintaining the fiction that underhive deaths resulted from criminal activity rather than official policy. My final report documented over 400 deaths directly attributable to the contaminated grain distribution, with detailed cross-references to the shipping manifests that proved deliberate targeting of specific population centers. The evidence was comprehensive and undeniable, presented in the precise format required by Imperial regulations for reporting crimes against the Imperium citizens. Each entry included corpse identification numbers, toxicological observations, and documentary proof linking the deaths to specific grain shipments. The decision to transmit the report directly to the Planetary Governor's Emergency Response Channel came after my previous attempts to work through proper channels had been systematically ignored or suppressed. The communication array in the waste facility provided access to priority transmission frequencies that bypassed local administrative filters, though using them without authorization was considered a serious offense that could result in immediate execution for interfering with Imperial communications. The transmission took nearly 6 hours to encode properly, with my deteriorating health making concentration increasingly difficult as I worked through the complex procedures required for priority channel access. My hands shook from exhaustion and chemical exposure as I input the authentication codes, while periodic coughing fits forced me to pause the work to avoid contaminating the equipment with blood. The final report contained 37 pages of documented evidence that would be impossible for authorities to dismiss or suppress. The response arrived within 2 hours of transmission, faster than any previous communication I had attempted with higher Imperial authorities. The acknowledgement confirmed receipt of my report and indicated that appropriate action would be taken to address the situation I had documented. For the first time in months of investigation, I felt genuine hope that my efforts might actually result in justice for the hundreds of people who had died from the contaminated grain distribution. The hope lasted exactly 18 hours before I realized that the rapid response to my transmission had been designed to identify and locate me rather than address the crimes I had documented. The waste facility's communication logs would have recorded my unauthorized use of the priority channels, while the authentication codes I had used could be traced back to my specific workstation. My final attempt to serve the Emperor's truth had simply marked me for elimination by the same corrupt system I had been trying to expose. The first indication of danger came when Supervisor Thrace approached my workstation during the morning shift, his scarred face showing an expression I had never seen before. He informed me that my work assignment was being modified to include special duties in the deep waste tunnels, areas of the facility that were typically avoided due to structural instability and toxic gas accumulation. The assignment was presented as routine rotation of personnel, but his nervous manner suggested he understood the real purpose of sending me into the most dangerous sections of the facility. The deep waste tunnels extended far beneath the main processing chambers, carved into the bedrock foundations of the hive structure, where the most hazardous materials were stored before final disposal. The air in these passages was thick with methane and hydrogen sulfide gases that could kill within minutes, while the tunnel walls wept chemical runoff that burned exposed skin on contact. Workers assigned to the deep tunnels rarely survived more than a few months before succumbing to toxic exposure or structural collapses. My breathing apparatus was a basic filtration mask that provided minimal protection against the concentrated gases in the deep tunnels, while my deteriorating respiratory condition made even filtered air difficult to process. Each step deeper into the tunnel system required tremendous effort, with frequent rest stops to prevent complete respiratory failure. The data slate containing my final report remained secured in my work clothes, the evidence of systematic murder weighing against my chest as I struggled through the toxic passages. The encounter with Jorik Vex occurred in Tunnel Section 7, approximately 2 kilometers from the main facility entrance where the structural supports were most corroded and the gas concentrations reached lethal levels. He emerged from a side passage with the casual confidence of someone familiar with the deep tunnel system, his gang leathers and improvised weapons marking him as one of the underhive enforcers who occasionally worked contract jobs for corrupt officials. His presence in the restricted waste tunnels was clearly not coincidental. Vex was a small man with the line build and quick movements of someone accustomed to violence in confined spaces, his face bearing the ritual scars that marked him as a member of one of the lower hive's numerous criminal organizations. His equipment consisted of basic gang weapons, including a rusty stub pistol and a collection of blades that showed evidence of regular use. The handful of thrown gelt coins he kept fingering in his jacket pocket suggested he had been paid recently for services rendered. The realization that I was facing my executioner came without surprise or fear, only a weary acceptance that my months of investigation had led inevitably to this moment in a toxic waste tunnel far beneath the hive structure. Vex approached with the business-like efficiency of someone completing a routine job, his movements suggesting he had performed similar tasks many times before. The corrupt officials who had ordered my elimination had chosen their instrument well, selecting someone who would kill without curiosity about his victim's identity or crimes. My attempt to explain the importance of the data slate was cut short by a violent coughing fit that left me gasping for breath in the toxic atmosphere of the tunnel. Blood sprayed from my lungs onto the corroded tunnel walls, while my legs gave out completely and left me collapsed against the chemical-stained bedrock. Vex watched my physical collapse with the detached interest of a professional evaluating his target's condition before completing his assigned task. The stub pistol appeared in Vex's hand with practiced smoothness as he positioned himself for the killing shot, though he seemed in no particular hurry to complete the execution. His casual examination of my deteriorating condition suggested he was considering whether the toxic atmosphere might finish the job without requiring direct action on his part. The delay gave me time to observe his face, noting the complete absence of malice or personal animosity in his expression as he prepared to end my life. The gunshot was surprisingly loud in the confined space of the waste tunnel, the sound echoing off the corroded walls and mixing with the constant dripping of chemical runoff from the ceiling. The Law's weapon burn in my chest was immediately agonizing, though the pain was quickly overwhelmed by the sensation of drowning as blood filled my lungs and made breathing impossible. I collapsed fully onto the tunnel floor, my body convulsing as I struggled unsuccessfully to draw breath through the fluid filling my respiratory system. Vex's search of my pockets was thorough and efficient, his hands moving through my work clothes with the systematic approach of someone experienced in looting corpses. He pocketed the few thrown gelt coins I carried for emergency expenses, along with my identification documents and the basic tools required for my waste processing duties. His examination of the data slate was cursory, treating it as potentially valuable electronic equipment rather than recognizing its contents as evidence of systematic murder. The data slate landed in a pool of chemical runoff approximately 3 meters from my dying body, its waterproof casing protecting the stored evidence even as the corrosive fluids began eating away at its external components. Vex counted his payment coins one final time before walking away down the tunnel, his footsteps gradually fading into the constant background noise of dripping chemicals and settling debris. The evidence of hundreds of murders lay discarded in toxic waste, as forgotten and disposable as the victims it documented. The final minutes of my life were spent choking on my own blood while staring at the data slate that contained months of careful investigation into systematic corruption and mass murder. My vision blurred and darkened as oxygen deprivation took hold, though consciousness persisted long enough for me to understand the complete futility of my dedication to truth and proper procedures. The evidence would dissolve in chemical runoff, my body would be processed through the same waste systems I had operated, and the crimes I had documented would continue without interruption. Jorik Vex emerged from the deep waste tunnels and reported to his gang contacts that the job had been completed successfully, collecting the remainder of his payment before returning to his normal activities in the Underhive criminal networks. The corrupt officials who had ordered my elimination received confirmation that their problem had been solved, allowing them to continue their profitable operations without interference from troublesome clerks who asked inconvenient questions about administrative irregularities. My body was discovered during routine tunnel maintenance 3 days later, processed through the same organic waste systems I had operated during my final assignment. The death was recorded as an industrial accident caused by toxic gas exposure in the deep tunnels, with no mention of gunshot wounds or evidence of foul play. The corpse processing facility added another entry to their statistics of workplace fatalities, maintaining the fiction that waste reclamation was simply a dangerous occupation rather than a convenient method for disposing of inconvenient witnesses. The data slate dissolved completely in the chemical runoff within a week of my death, its evidence of systematic murder destroyed by the same toxic environment that had killed me. The contaminated grain distribution continued targeting Underhive populations, while the ammunition sabotage and weapons trafficking operations expanded to serve growing demand from corrupt officials throughout the Hive structure. My lifetime of honesty and dedication to Imperial service had accomplished nothing except ensuring my own destruction in service of a system that valued compliance over truth. The final irony was that my death achieved what months of careful investigation could not, becoming another statistic in the endless cycle of violence and corruption that defined life in Hive Tertius. My name joined the anonymous thousands process through the waste reclamation systems, my sacrifice forgotten as completely as the evidence I had died trying to preserve. The Emperor's truth remained buried beneath layers of systematic deception, while the corrupt prospered and the innocent continued dying in the darkness of the Underhive levels.